This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There can be little hope left for six miners trapped deep inside the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah. In the more than 3 weeks since the mine caved in, there's been no sign of life, and three would-be rescuers died in a second collapse. Drilling continues on what's called a borehole, a small shaft just big enough to lower a camera, but if, like six earlier boreholes, this one also comes up empty, agonizing decisions may have to be made to end the rescue and to figure out how to recover the men's bodies if, in fact, they can be recovered at all. Today we'll discuss how those decisions get made, who makes them, what factors they weigh, and how families cope with the fact that loved ones may never be found. Later in the program, historian Douglas Brinkley on the hard choices we all face on New Orleans and why he thinks the Bush administration is hiding the truth. But first, from rescue to recovery, how do you make that decision? How much effort and money should be spent to recover bodies when all hope of life is gone? How do families cope when there's no body to bury? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Michael McNamee, who's made such decisions. He was the fire chief on the scene at the Worcester Cold Storage and Warehouse Fire in December 1999. Six firefighters died in that building. He's now the district fire chief for the city of Worcester, Massachusetts. And Chief McNamee, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
It's a pleasure.
And when that fire first began, it wasn't considered very threatening, but then quickly developed into what you've described as the building from hell.
Oh, yes, it did. When we first began our operation, it was just another routine fire. But then the building, within a matter of 5 seconds, it turned from perfectly good visibility, relatively benign, to a midnight black, floor-to-ceiling structure that was just completely filled with smoke, with absolutely no visibility, and the heat built up tremendously.
And how soon did you realize you had six men lost inside?
Oh, the alarm came in at 6:13, and we got our first distress call at 6:46 in the evening. And it was about 6:46, again, when the first distress call came, and we began our search at that point. At that point, two of our people had become lost looking for homeless people that were reported in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And we began our search, and we searched continuously on three floors. Now, you have to picture this building. This is an 80-foot-tall building that had no windows above the second floor, had 18-inch thick brick walls, and we had to send crew after crew after crew in trying to find these lost firefighters who were communicating with us. But
well, they couldn't tell you, though, where they were.
Well, one of the things that happened that night was they had gone directly to the roof by an aerial ladder. And what had happened was when they heard the call that there might be homeless people living in the building, they entered the structure from the roof and went down a stairway from the roof. We were conducting our search based on counting floors from the bottom up. They told us that they were two floors below the roof. Now, remember, this is a building with no windows.
Right.
So you couldn't go outside and count floors. We weren't sure how many floors there were. We estimated 5 to 7. They said they were two floors below the roof. So what that ended up dictating to me was that I started a search going on three separate floors, which stretched our resources out even thinner. We were searching the third, the fourth, and the fifth floors for these guys.
Yeah, and though they couldn't tell you where they were, I understand you did hear something that told you you had little time left.
Oh, absolutely. By the second transmission, I could hear the firefighters' low air alarm sounding, which means that they have approximately 2 minutes of air left. And in those kinds of conditions, with the smoke as toxic and as thick and rich as it was, that kind of smoke will take you down by your sixth breath. Your legs are buckling under you. By your tenth breath, you're losing consciousness. That's what a lot of people don't realize, how quickly it will take you down.
You were the one who had to make the decision to stop the rescue effort, that it was just simply too dangerous to send more men into that fire when you knew there was no air left in those men's tanks. But It must have been the most difficult decision you've ever made.
It was the most difficult, but I can still remember I was never more clear in my decision as I was. I did not make it. It was not a spontaneous decision. I thought it through. We had what had happened in the meantime, we had lost four others in the process of the search. First, it was two that got lost looking for the homeless people. And then about a half an hour later, we lost contact with four others of our people that we never heard from again. And then we continued the search for another. All told, the search went on for about an hour and 14 minutes. And at that point, we had a very experienced lieutenant who'd been on the job for decades. He came downstairs, and he sat on the bottom of the steel stairs that were in that stairwell, and his he was so hot, his gear was steaming, completely steaming. His helmet, his coat, his pants, everything was just giving steam off. And he pulled his breathing mask off, and he looked at me, and he said, "Chief, I couldn't even make it past the third floor this time." That's when I knew. I looked out. There was about a dozen firefighters lined up waiting to go up, and I knew that it was going to be sending good after bad. I looked at some of those people that were out there, that had some who I've known for more than 20 years. I knew some of their wives, their children, and I just could not send them back up there anymore. Because I knew in my heart that all six of them were gone, that this was not going to be a rescue anyway, and this was going to be sending good after bad. We have a kind of a cold term in the fire service. The risk-benefit analysis: is the benefit worth the risk that you're about to ask people to take?
Yet you knew, of course, you would have to face those men's families. And as I understand it, there's also a code of firefighters, knowing that if you go into a burning building, your buddies will do everything they possibly can to get you out.
Absolutely. You know, like in any business, you get to know who the good players are, who the mediocre players are. You know who you can rely on. And one thing that we have to do in businesses like this is know that if we get in trouble, every effort is going to be expended to get us out of that problem. And part of our problem, too, was on our department. We're a large urban department, the second largest in New England. And prior to that, we had not lost a firefighter to a violent line-of-duty death. You know, we've had our heart attacks and our aneurysms, but not a violent line-of-duty death like that in since 1963. So in our minds, we've been in many tight spots before, and in our minds, we always said to ourselves, anybody gets in trouble, we can pull this off, we can get it done. But that night, we didn't. That night, the part of the burden is the fact that we know we let those guys down. We failed to get them out.
Chief McNamee, thank you so much for sharing your story. I know that can't be easy either.
Well, it's part of who we are here now.
Michael McNamee was the fire chief at the site of the Worcester Fire in 1999, in which six firefighters were killed. He's now the district fire chief for the city of Worcester and spoke to us from his office there. There are similar kinds of cultures in the military. Joining us now is retired Marine Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor. He led combat commands in both the Korean and Vietnam Wars. And General Traynor, nice to have you back on the program.
Good afternoon, Neil.
And just as there's a sense of brotherhood among firefighters, as we heard from Chief McNamee, there's also a very strong sense of brotherhood and bonding in the military that leads to the ethos that no man will be left behind.
Yes, it's very similar. We both, I think, operate under the same codes.
Now, you experienced it firsthand, a raid in the Korean War, when one of the men in your platoon was killed on the battlefield.
Yeah, well, Neil, the presumption is that nobody is going to be left behind, whether they're wounded or killed. And I think two things motivate that. Number one is the bonding that takes place, particularly in a combat organization. And the second thing is the fear of the individual to be left alone and left to die and his body left out there in no man's land. And not to pick up wounded and dead and bring them back to safety has a very deleterious effect upon the troops. Now, the incident that I'm going to relate, it actually was not in the battalion that I was in, but it was the adjacent battalion. They'd run a raid on a Chinese position, and at the end of the raid, they withdrew, but there was one man that was killed that was unaccounted for. These were night raids, and in the confusion of the withdrawal, his body was left behind. Well, when the day came up, you could see the body in front of the Chinese trench line, And this had a terrible impact on the troops. And the position that I was in, I could see it also off to my left. So they mounted a raid to go out just to recover the body. And I think they did that maybe two, possibly even three times. My memory fails me on that. But a number of occasions, they went out to try to get the body back. And each time, we took additional casualties. So it does get to the point, as described by the chief there as a cost-benefit analysis, you know, that the presumption was overridden by the reality. We couldn't afford to lose any more bodies. But the impact was still terrible because the troopers could see this guy's body lying out there. So the decision was made over in that battalion to destroy the body, and they called in an airstrike, and they dropped napalm and cremated the body so it could no longer be seen. But it's a very traumatic experience, and no professional fighting man ever wants to leave one of his buddies alone out there, dead or alive.
Dead or alive, if there's doubt, I can understand. But if you know that the man is dead, is it worth risking other men's lives?
Well, there comes a tip-over point where if you're risking too many lives, you really shouldn't do it. But even that is very difficult to digest. But you're willing to take casualties in order to bring back the body of one of your buddies because, as I say, this fear is always in the mind of the troops that they don't want to be left out there. Even if they're killed, they want to know that they're being brought back by their buddies. One of the incidents in the Vietnamese War, which is in a book and then made into a movie, it was called Bat 21, mm-hmm. which was the code sign of this pilot who was shot down in North Vietnamese territory. And the Air Force went to extraordinary measures to bring the individual back, even to the point of interfering with ongoing operations so that they could send their people in to rescue him. Fortunately, he was eventually rescued. But there's this overwhelming desire on anybody that's in a close profession like the military and indeed like the fire department, as previously described, that you're not going to leave anybody behind and you'll risk anything. And people will volunteer for this. You don't have to.
General Traynor, stay with us if you would. We'll be back with more. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Douglas Brinkley will be here a little later in the hour. It's his position that New Orleans has been all but abandoned by the federal government, and he wishes they'd admit that. We'll talk with him about that. But right now, rescue and recovery in Utah, rescuers are still trying to locate six trapped miners. After more than 3 weeks, though, there's little hope that anyone will be found alive. How do you make the decision to shift from rescue to recovery? How much effort and money should be spent to recover bodies when all hope of life is gone? How do families cope when there's no body to bury? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guest is retired Marine Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor. And let's see if we can get a caller on the line. This is Tony, and Tony's with us from Fort Wayne in Indiana.
Yes, hello, how are you doing today?
I'm well, Tony, thank you.
Yes, I have a comment. You had two comparisons with the fire department and the military, which are not profit-making enterprises, whereas the mine is a profit-making enterprise where mining companies are notorious for knowing that they've lobbied Congress to get safety regulations cut down, they've lobbied Congress to not pay royalties on public lands. So my comment is they should follow the role of the fire department and the military, is that if a mining operator is doing all this for profit, then their profits are obligated to save the men if they happen to be trapped in a mine or perish, to get out their bodies at whatever cost, even if it makes that mine owner bankrupt. That is just immoral, in my opinion, that he will stop rescue efforts, even if to recover the bodies, because he's afraid he's going to lose money. That's my comment.
Even if it's not safe to go back into the mine?
Okay, but the military person brought up a good point. There will be plenty of volunteers. If someone is willing to volunteer, and if they proceed to redig that mine shaft under proper safety that they've lobbied to cut out to save costs,
right.
And even if it takes years to redig that shaft, but properly, and as long as it's not taxpayer money and it's a profit that land, that mine owner has made over those years, he's obligated to spend every dime to get out the people that has made him so wealthy.
And I understand your point, Tony, but what about the other people who still work for him? If he goes bankrupt, they will be out of work.
People are out of work all the time. And if
okay, all right, that's your position, even if people...
Right, and those quality people will find work elsewhere, and why would they want to work for someone that will let them die at any day for unsafe, possibly unsafe
right.
procedures?
I think we get your point, Tony. I wonder, General Traynor, do you see the analogy?
Well, yes, that's a little bit out of my lane, Neil, but I think I have to agree in principle up to a point. You know, it is a subjective judgment as to what you do in these circumstances. And again, I feel the presumption that is that you should do everything possible, but there does come the tipping point where it's counterproductive to carry on the effort. And that's the best I can do on it. Mm-hmm. It's subjective, and there'll always be criticism whatever decision is made.
Yeah, and why we wanted to talk with people who've witnessed or made such decisions is that it's easy to make a cost-benefit analysis if it's not you and yours.
That's absolutely right. You know, you have with these organizations like the military and the fire department, the police department, and many others, they're a band of brothers, brothers and sisters. And the idea of having somebody put in a position where they are going to be literally forgotten in their extremists, I think that is absolutely cruel and unpalatable to people that are part of the band.
Let's get Brian on the line. Brian's calling us from Boise, Idaho.
Yeah, my question,
Brian?
Deaths in Korea and Vietnam. I wonder what changed in the imperial American psyche that they started.
Brian, your phone is cutting in and out. We're going to give you one last shot.
Hi, Neil. Okay.
Brian, can you hear me? I think Brian's question had to do, at least is what he told our screener, was what was the prompted the change from World War II to send the dead in military dead back home as opposed to the previous decisions to, for example, the very profound and moving cemetery at Normandy in France. General Traynor, do you have any ideas about that?
Well, as I understand it, they. Of course, transportation was a different issue in those days than it is today, where we have aerial transport to bring the deceased home. At that time, they were buried, generally speaking, on the spot, whether it's at Omaha Beach or in Iwo Jima. But then, as I understand it, the families were given the option later on to have the remains disinterred and returned to the States to a national cemetery or private cemetery at the call of the loved ones. And I think that is what prevails, and I suspect underneath our modern transportation system that still would apply.
General Traynor, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Neil.
Bernard Traynor, a retired lieutenant general in the United States Marine Corps. He spoke to us from his home in Virginia. Part of saying goodbye when a loved one goes is the ritual that surrounds their passage. But how do you grieve when the remains are not available? Joining us now is clinical psychologist Therese Rando. She's clinical director of the Institute for the Study and Treatment of Loss in Warwick, Rhode Island, and joins us today from the studios of member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
And I know you've been listening to these men, the fire chief and the general, talk about their cultures, but this goes throughout our culture and many others, that it's so important to have the body to mourn.
Yes, it does. And as a matter of fact, we know that a classic Greek play was written about this, Sophocles' Antigone, about getting her brother back, how important it was to get the dead body back. It's extremely crucial for human beings to give respect and to care for their loved one last time. Now, in some circumstances, it's not quite as relevant as others because perhaps this was a death that was expected and you've had the opportunity to care for. To start to prepare for the death of your loved one. Perhaps there's been an illness that that person has had for a while. But in cases of sudden death, when there has been no expectation, no anticipation per se, where you couldn't see this coming down the pike, it's extremely important because the mind can't quite grasp it, Neil. We need to have proof. We need to have evidence that this has happened. And, of course, the best evidence, if you will, is the body of that loved person. because that is the best representation of that person. And that's why psychologists, mental health professionals urge people in those circumstances where it can be done to consider viewing the body or mm-hmm. that part of the body that is viewable when there's been a sudden death, because we know that it helps to start to reinforce the reality of what's happened.
And one of the things that, of course, we've noticed in tragedies, including the mine collapse in Utah, September the 11th, the Pentagon, other situations like that, too many other situations like that, family members in particular will sometimes go to extraordinary lengths to keep believing that their loved one is still alive somewhere.
Well, I think it's not that they go to those lengths. I think they find themselves at those lengths. It's very difficult if you haven't had the ability to start to anticipate this happening. Your loved one is alive at breakfast. He or she is dead at lunch. It's very difficult to grasp this. Even when there is a body that is available, we know that it can take up to 2 years before a person can fully grasp 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that their loved one is gone and is not coming back. And this isn't denial per se in most cases. Many times it's disbelief. A person's been so much a part of your life and then all of a sudden isn't there. So we have to learn that reality that they have died and are no longer going to be there as before. And one of the ways we learn that is in having the ritual of tending to, caring for, honoring, respecting the body of our loved one. So in situations when that can't happen, the mourner really is robbed of something that we know has some therapeutic benefits for many, many people throughout the ages.
Is there anything you might say to a family member in circumstances where it's simply the body of the recovery of the body is just not going to happen?
Well, I think it has to be acknowledged that this is a very difficult situation for people. And to whatever extent at the proper point in time, I could have them communicate with other people who have dealt with this, for example, families of 9/11 victims, mm-hmm. or perhaps families of boaters lost at sea and so forth, to first of all help legitimize for them that this difficulty, these challenges that are placed upon them in the situation, while they can make things additionally difficult for a while, they don't have to preclude people from going on with their mourning, but it will make it a little more difficult. And I would also encourage them that they do have some way of having a ritual. Perhaps there's not a body to acknowledge, but there needs to be some kind of ritual, a memorial service, perhaps a burying of something, symbolic possession, what have you, of the person who died. There needs to be given expression, the human need to give testimony to the fact that someone who was loved has died and is no longer with us, and that we need to show our feelings about that. And without the body, then we'll need to find an acceptable substitute for that, Neil.
We're talking with Therese Rando, a clinical psychologist, about the difficulties of mourning without a body. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Here's an email we have from Janet in Palo Alto, California. One thing that would haunt me if I were one of the miner's loved ones would be the possibility that if they did not die right away, they left some sort of message. In situations like that, people often do. To me, recovering that message would be much more important than recovering the body for reburial. You could see she's got a point.
Absolutely. And I think that this is another reason why we spend so much time and effort trying to ascertain the circumstances of our loved one's death. I've worked with many people, for instance, when there has been a suicide, and families have spent enormous time looking for notes or messages, or was there something that could indicate why this happened. It is because we not only want to have a sense of connection with that person that we've lost, but we also want to try to figure out what happened, what were they feeling, what was it like. I think in 9/11, we saw this happen in a very dramatic way, where unbeknownst or what had not happened before was we had people actually on the phone with their loved ones when that loved one was facing death imminently, mm-hmm. and they were able to contact them. Now, some people that was very helpful for. Other people, it was additionally traumatizing. But the point is that for those individuals who want to know what were the thoughts, what were the feelings, what did they go through, any kind of message, or even how the bodies were in what position and so forth, is very important. And so psychologically, it gives us more information to help us try to contend with this very difficult experience of having this unanticipated event suddenly come into our lives.
Again, our guest is Therese Rando, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And Ms. Rando, you spoke earlier about the Antigone, of course, the famous Greek play, but Homer, too, the great concern of Priam to get back the body of his son Hector dragged around the walls of Troy. That's all Western culture. Does this same kind of psychology manifest itself in other cultures, too?
Well, I think we have seen in recent years, unfortunately, where the desecration of the bodies of our soldiers, for instance, has been broadcast in the war and before that, for instance, in Mogadishu. And there, I think, is a general acknowledgement that that is quite a horrific thing to do, and it is done, I believe, to demean and to demoralize and to further traumatize. So while I'm not an expert on other cultures, the fact that this is done, it is broadcast and so forth, I think suggests that people in other cultures are very aware of the fact that we respect our dead. And in fact, in most civilizations, you're going to find that there is a very big consideration given to what happens to the body, even if they're doing something that might not be personally comfortable to some people in Western society. For instance, setting the body on an ice floe, or perhaps for some people, cremating on a funeral pyre. Yet in those cultures, that is an appropriate and maybe even spiritual thing to do. So we do know that having respect for the body after the death is not just a Western tradition.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Erica. Erica with us from Phoenix in Arizona.
Hello.
Hi.
I listen to your show every day.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask you, see, I lost my brother in March, and it was quite sudden. He was actually on a waiting list for a heart, and he passed away, and we found out the same day and drove out the same day. He was about 3 hours away from where we are. We saw him around 11 that night on a stretcher, wrapped in his sheet still, and had to make a decision because we weren't in a financial state to afford a casket or a funeral service to cremate him. And he was the first that we've ever done that to in our family. In our family, we usually mourn overnight with the body present. We usually, you know, do the whole service, and we weren't able to do that this time. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to see where his ashes were laid to rest.
It sounds like this has been hard for you, Erica.
Yeah, it has. Yeah. I just wanted to ask, how can I get past, you know, the nightmares and the dreams where he gets up from the stretcher, which was the last place I saw him.
Therese Rando, any advice you might be able to give?
Well, first of all, I want to offer my condolences.
Thank you.
And I also want to say that to have these kinds of nightmares and dreams at this point in time, since this was a death that had occurred fairly recently, might not be something that is going to persist. We can hope that it wouldn't. However, if because of your feeling that you did not have sufficient time to spend with your brother, you're not clear on where his cremains are and so forth, that may leave you with what we call unfinished business and a sense of a kind of a trauma. And in that regard, that would not be an unusual thing, but I would suggest that it would be less an issue of what can I do myself, but perhaps to talk with someone who has some information about that and can help you articulate some of the concerns that you have about being in that situation, especially when it goes against what your usual rituals are, Erica. It's very challenging and can make it very difficult for you, although not undoable if you get proper support.
And I kind of do feel alone because my family did get to go and lay his ashes to rest with his mother. He was adopted.
I see.
So it might be very helpful to try to find someone with whom you can create a ritual so that you can have a formal goodbye ritual for your brother.
Thank you.
Erica, again, our condolences and good luck to you.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank Therese Rando for her time today. We appreciate your coming by to join us.
You're welcome.
Therese Rando, clinical director of the Institute for the Study and Treatment of Loss and the author of several books on grief. Her latest, Coping with the Sudden Death of Your Loved One, is due out this fall. She joined us today from the studios of member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Coming up, historian Douglas Brinkley on the political abandonment of New Orleans and the era of Katrina. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.